Hi everyone, I'm Chris Saldana, and this is the National Education Policy Center's Education Interview of the Month. Let me start by saying that I hope everyone listening is safe and healthy. There's no denying that we're currently living through one of our nation's most challenging and trying times. Because of this, this month's interview presents the experiences of educational stakeholders who have been charged with providing and fighting for a free and high-quality public education for all students in the midst of a global pandemic. In this month's podcast, we've brought together five of these individuals to share their stories. Jillian McRae is a high school teacher at Ossining High School in New York City. Ann Dealey is the principal of Brookside School, an elementary school in the Ossining Union Free School District in New York. Saun Bell is a community activist and organizer who works with the statewide community organization Californians for Justice. Kyle Surrett is a senior policy analyst at the National Education Association, and Keith Catone is executive director of the Center for Youth and Community Leadership in Education at Roger Williams University. Thank you all for being with us today. So Jillian, I want to start with you. I think as a teacher, the transition to an online classroom has been abrupt. So what challenges have you experienced in transitioning your students to learning exclusively via technology? And how have you tried to support your students emotionally through this time?
It's a great question, and I'll speak very much from my particular situation. I am a high school English teacher. I do co-teach a college level senior class, and it's called SUNY Racism, Classism, Sexism. So my co-teacher and I, when we're in the flesh with our students, we have 95 students, about 45, and then like 48 in one class. So it's chaos to begin with. And then moving into this online platform has brought a different set of challenges too, because how do I check in with about 95 students a day? And we have, and I think it's been trying, and it takes a lot of energy, and I'm in front of my screen a lot longer than I would like to be, but it's worthwhile just to make sure that their access to learning and their access to us essentially and their classmates isn't interrupted. So a question that we posed last week was, what color are you feeling and why? And the students, of course, responded in rainbow form, right? Like some of them were like, I'm orange, I just got into college, I'm feeling great. And overwhelmingly, I believe the colors that won that day were blue and gray, you know, and it was a rainy day when I posed the question. They were down. They were, you know, realizing that they miss the kind of physical connections that they have with their friends. So I used Google's Excel and Sheets and plotted it out so that I could then share the result. And then I sent out a mass message, kind of, I want to honor like where everybody is right now. And I want to tell you that you're not alone, right? Like, look at the chart. You're not the only one feeling this particular color. You're not the only one feeling this particular way. So these like questions of the days, which really I'm not using in an academic sense at all, but are really just a way to kind of take the temperature and check in, have been so great in terms of giving me info about my kids. But it really gives me a space to kind of begin talking to them in a much more personal way, right? The types of conversations that we would have if we were in the classroom and you come in a couple of minutes early and we're kind of just chatting and checking in. I'm doing this on like a larger scale. And I like it. And it's something that I may continue doing once we're back in the flesh as well. You know, it's just a nice, like, anonymous way to kind of like, your teacher cares about you and is reading everything that you are submitting and writing. And I care about the whole person. I care about you academically, but I also care about you socially, emotionally, mentally, and how you're kind of weathering this storm that we've all found ourselves in.
So, Anne, I think a number of concerns are raised when we think about the impact that school closures can immediately have on a school's most vulnerable students. How have you tried to attend to the needs of all of your students, for example, emerging bilingual students and those students who may rely on their school for food or shelter? And what approach have you taken to trying to support your faculty and staff through these challenging times?
So our immediate and most urgent concern was for our vulnerable students. first and foremost, the primary needs of shelter. Some of our families share apartments and homes, and it's difficult if someone becomes ill or if they're quarantined. It's difficult to isolate from each other. So we wanted to make sure all of our kids had adequate space, as well as to access to medical care and mental health, particularly for our new arrived students and families. So once we just ensured that children and families had their primary needs met, then we tried to identify secondary concerns, but also vital for access and distance learning, being communication and technology. Did we have an adequate phone number, a working email, which is the way the distance lessons have been communicated? So we wanted, for some people, we had to set them up with email. And then we needed to make sure that they had technology. So our first week of distance learning for our vulnerable students was really identifying these needs and trying to respond to each family, you know, and their immediate crisis, but then also looking at patterns so that we develop more systemic responses. Again, what we really found is our newly arrived families we're really just experiencing compounded trauma. And we've also just identified things we didn't realize before. So definitely our dominant language in the community is Spanish, but we realize that we have students who speak Arabic and we have students who speak Japanese. And we've had to leverage resources in our community we've had to rely on parents and say, we need you to communicate with this family. And that has been one, you know, rainbow in the sky here, is that everybody has been really come together as a community to make sure that people have what they need and that we can all try to stay healthy together. I think I would be remiss if I didn't talk about how do we support faculty and staff. So first and foremost, they feel the needs of families while they're also trying to meet the needs of their own family. We have a shared commitment to making sure that families have what they need, and that weighs very heavy on teachers. And then they're learning to new technology. They're trying to be responsive to how are they going to help parents help kids access new learning. So we've been trying to replicate our restorative circles that we do in faculty meetings, on our faculty hangouts, and making sure that we check in with each other. Today, I ended a meeting just knowing that we were engaging in some PD on new technology, and I could just tell that everybody was saturated. And it's the first day here in New York where we've had some sun. And I said, this is where we just call it a day, friends. And I'd urge you to all take a walk, absorb some sunshine, absorb some fresh air, and that, you know, we cancel others if we're empty ourselves. I'm encouraging the teachers, but I think I'm encouraging them to encourage each other to just take good care, because again, if people are empty, they're just not able to give to others.
So Salun, throughout our nation's history, communities of color and low-income communities have consistently pushed for better public schools that offer more equitable learning opportunities to kids. I think this pandemic has exposed both the central role schools play in our society and the incredible inequality that exists across schools and communities. So in your conversations with community members, how have you found that communities are responding to this crisis? And how do you think that this response is indicative of what communities can offer public schools now and going forward?
Yeah, you know, the coronavirus pandemic, you know, for us over in California, is a crisis that is really testing the foundations of our public infrastructures. How much our young people and families and communities depend on them in their everyday lives. And that's what it's really been uncovering. And what it does additionally is that it uncovers what elected leaders have continued to sweep under the rug, right? And that is that communities of color and low-income communities have endured schools that are woefully under-resourced and easily overwhelmed by the many different needs of students and their families. You know, how important public infrastructures are, especially in a place like California, where we have the fifth largest amount of wealth in the world. And yet, you know, we are not immune to this crisis, right? We see our public infrastructures, our public schools under just a tremendous amount of pressure. You know, the other thing that I definitely wanted to name was that, you know, for communities of color and low-income communities who have consistently pushed for exceptional public schools, it's really because we know that our schools are our anchors in our communities, right? And that we know that we don't live single-issue lives, nor do we live in single-issue communities. You know, the pandemic is really just bringing the best out in people. You know, people are pulling together to share resources, technology, information, and food so that families can continue to meet their needs. And, you know, for us, like many, for the many families and the young people that we work with, you know, pulling it together is not really, you know, it's not an option. And then the other thing that we're seeing is in a place like California, there's a huge gap in internet and access to information. And so, like, what happens when you have places like in rural Fresno, where there aren't internet towers, or in Coachella Valley, where internet is limited, what happens to those families, and how do they get access to information, and how do they access the resources that they need in this particular crisis? But you know, I've seen us organizers really respond by engaging in all means of communication. We are isolated, but we know that we're not alone. And this is a critical moment for us to really provide inspiring, humanity-affirming solutions, particularly for our schools. And what we are realizing is scarcity, like this sort of narrative that is told about when it comes to our public schools, that, oh, there aren't enough resources, there isn't enough this, we can't do this, this can't be prioritized. That is a myth. That is something that this crisis has illuminated, that a lot of these things around what we cannot do, what is not possible, are myths, right? And we actually have the resources and the creative solutions to meet the needs of children, of young people, and families in our communities. And you know, the one thing that we've been really grappling with is, you know, how do we not go back to the status quo? And that's something that, you know, communities are especially keen on. Where our schools are expected to be roses that grow on concrete, right? That has been the expectation, and you know, that is an expectation that we do not want to walk into, you know, post-pandemic.
So Kyle, nationally, the response has been varied. I want to build on my question to Saun and talk to you about how you see this crisis as an opportunity to highlight the value that a community schools approach can bring across contexts.
You know, all systems are perfectly created to get the results that they get. That kind of means that the school-to-prison pipeline is designed to get the results that they get, and the really wealthy or well-off neighborhoods are designed to get the results that they get. The real question in times of crisis and non-crisis are, how well do we understand those systems, and do we have in place key strategies to redesign systems so that we can get to that key word of equity? To me, equity really means I picture a little kid and they dream about being something, and their zip code doesn't determine whether they can get there or not. So in a time of crisis, systems are tested. So a broken system breaks further. A well-knit-together system shows resilience. And we are starting to see that in community schools across the country. You know, a key tool in the needs in a community school is a needs assessment, right? In San Francisco, they just started the teachers doing needs assessments with all the parents saying, just checking in. One, we are the school system, and how are you doing in this time of crisis? Number two, tell us about what you need. Tell us about what you want. Tell us, you know, so that they weren't guessing on the school level, but they were knowing exactly what was going on and they could respond to it. And that's our job nationally, is to try to get to primary source data so that we don't guess about what's going on, but we can actually know. And so I personally don't think that it's enough to have a monthly, you know, oil check, right? You kind of dip in and you figure out where you're at. We're moving so fast in this crisis that we need primary source data on a regular basis. So what we need to do is mobilize the people that we have right now so that we can get into a place where we are on an everyday basis starting to understand what their needs are. there really is only one strategy out there that goes into those 4,500 hours that kids spend outside of school and the 1,000 hours that kids spend inside of school. And that's a community school strategy. And you could put whatever is necessary inside of that strategy in order to get to the results that we want. Meaning that if a school needs greater math supports, then that's what they need. And if they need more culturally relevant curriculum, then that is what they need. It's not a prescriptive approach, other than the fact that you need to deeply understand the needs of stakeholders.
So Keith, I think it goes without saying that public schools bring an incredible amount of value to our society. But how does this crisis further emphasize the role public schools currently play in the United States? And what does this tell us about how public schools should be supported going forward?
Yeah, so my organization, CYCLE, is the Center for Youth and Community Leadership in Education. And our vision statement, I think, addresses this head on. And so I'm just going to read that vision statement, which is, CYCLE believes that high quality public schools and equitable education systems are the cornerstone of an authentic democracy and a just society. By centering and prioritizing the experiences and expertise of people most negatively impacted by racial, cultural, and class-based hierarchies, public education can be a means to achieving collective liberation through dismantling systems of oppression. And so, you know, the question makes me think about our vision statement. And with that in mind, in this historical moment, we're witnessing the many ways in which our public schools really practically serve as the cornerstones of our communities. So on top of the obvious educational functions they play to support student learning, they support health, nourishment, safety, and security for the youngest members of our society. But on top of that, they're also in so much clearer stark relief, they're economic linchpins for our communities. They're not just as institutions that, of course, employ thousands of people and drive a multi-billion dollar industry, but they enable parents to work during the day as opposed to being full-time homeschoolers, which many of us have become. They're centers for voting and information sharing and so much of the civic life in communities. And that goes for urban communities to suburban to rural communities. All communities have the schools serve as these civic centers, really. And, you know, so for me, this underscores the importance of the visions that our communities really have and have always had in terms of from the social justice, education justice organizing field for public education. So in particular, in Providence, where we're located, we're part of an alliance of grassroots youth organizing groups called Our Schools PVD. And the young people in that alliance before the pandemic developed what we call the 3D platform for Providence Public Schools. And those 3Ds are democracy, dollars, and dignity. And as the current crisis really underscores the important ways our public education system undergirds our democracy, right? It's in dire need of adequate and equitable resources. And there are places where young people and families and communities really develop dreams for a dignified future. I really hope that as that becomes more clear, we're going to double down on our support for public education going forward. It's something that communities have been calling for and then in an understanding at in their core, but now I think it's on display, right? And so the 3D framing really implies, and the reason, one of the reasons we use it, is we need to understand public schools as three-dimensional institutions, right? They're not flat or single layered, but really are institutions with depth and complexity. And then in the future, and now and in the future, they require our society's really broad commitment and an increased investment going forward.
So usually we conclude the podcast by asking our guests to provide recommendations to our listeners. And usually these recommendations are along educational policy lines. I want to divert from that a little bit only because I know that in these trying times, it can be particularly difficult to find hope. So I wanted to ask each of you to provide one recommendation to our listeners, but also to describe how you're finding hope in this situation, how you are reminding yourself that even though these are incredibly difficult and challenging times, that if we continue to pull together, that we will make it to the other side. Jillian, why don't we start with you?
I remember when I talked to my daughter and she was saying that her campus was closing down. I thought about kids who are home insecure, right? And so, like, what does it mean that this space that you were supposed to be living in for at least 8 months is now being shut down, and where do you go? So I think the first thing is that we have to be mindful. My class, before we had this break in our face-to-face education, we took our kids outside for a privilege walk, you know, and, we did like the customary, people have seen it on YouTube, those customary questions of access of privilege or not, right? So, you know, step forward if you grew up in a home that had more than 50 books, step back perhaps if you're raised in a single parent household. And we love doing this with our kids so that they can see themselves among their classmates, among their friends, so that they can realize and tap into these spaces of privilege that perhaps they weren't aware of before. They really are taking stock of where they are in this world, because if you just listen to like what's happening, if you tune into the TV, if you're listening to the radio, and we hear these stories, which remind us of how vulnerable we all are, but then think of other people who experience these vulnerabilities on a much larger scale. We really have to take stock of like our positionality, right? And our position in terms of who we are and what we have. And I think out of all the horror that is happening in this, like there are like moments of beauty. There are moments of like, wow, we'll never like look at a nurse the same, you know, we'll always applaud them from the core of our being. And so, you know, what can we take away from that? I would love for people out there just to recognize, right, the systems that we have in place, the systems of access and the systems that where our kids cannot access. Like, let's look at all the things that we had to do now in this time of crisis, so that we can put into place when we're not in crisis and we really want to kind of, you know, make things more equitable. Like these are the holes that we had to fill before. Can we like keep those holes covered so that we can address people the way they need to be addressed?
Thank you, Jillian. Anne, how about you?
Well, faith is always what gets me through everything. So I would say that that's a particular pillar right now. Also, just to watch the incredible way that people have risen to this challenge, to feel the community of our district, to, you know, participating in a food drive recently, you know, people come through. I also think that it's important that it's an opportunity for teachers and staff members to see in this distance learning setting that we need to rely on families, and it gives a sense that we need to see them as capable. It's not just what they need, it's what they have to offer. So really being able to see home and families as a source of strength and an asset.
Saun, how have you been dealing with these times?
You know, I mentioned this earlier, we are isolated, but we're definitely not alone. My recommendation would be to ensuring that the voices of young people and parents are at decision-making tables, you know, as we sort of try to figure out what school and learning is going to look like throughout like social distancing. And then additionally, like what kind of schools will young people be entering into post-pandemic, right? Because we know that our communities have very varied and unique needs, right? And so we want to make sure that those folks, right, that are impacted the most, right, have a seat at that table, and that seat at that table is meaningful, and that folks feel very much a part of building a school community that works for all of us.
Thank you, Saun. Kyle, how about yourself?
I feel like America's cancer has been our education system. Mm-hmm. Where, like we talked about earlier, we have a zip code issue where you're born in a certain place and that's the type of education you get. You're born in a different place and you get a totally different type of education. And the reason why I use the term cancer is because I think we have the cure as well. We know that in Cincinnati, they had the lowest performing school district in all of Ohio. Then they turned all their schools into community schools, which they call community learning centers. And now it's the highest performing urban district in Ohio. We know that. We know that Kentucky used to be the worst place to go in the whole country to get an education. Then in the 1990s, because of an equity lawsuit, they turned 93% of their schools into community schools, and now it's ranked 27th in the country, and it has the lowest gap between rich and poor out of any state out there. It's the odd thing that we have the answer, we have the cure. Question is, how do we get to a place where everyone who needs it has it? And I'm really heartened by the fact that we have education justice coalitions across the country that are mobilizing and using their power to win community schools. So it's not this slow organic growth process, but it's stimulated by powerful organizations that can grow. On the other level, I think my job is to make it so that we can learn from each other. So our big cities where we're operating in and our rural cities, we should not be recreating each other's mistakes in this time. Someone in rural Iowa might have an amazing idea that can influence Los Angeles, and we should know that. And that's the reason why we're not all atomized in this work, right? Like, the reason why we don't atomize is so that we can learn from each other. That was our strategy before, and it remains our strategy now. It's just for a different purpose.
Finally, Keith, what recommendation would you give to our listeners? And how have you been finding hope in this time?
Sure. So, you know, not so much a policy recommendation as much as sort of going back to what I was speaking about before in working with young people. I think working with young people right now is really giving me hope. And I think it's where I go to whenever I'm asked a question like this in various contexts. But I mentioned the Our Schools PVD Alliance, and it hasn't skipped a beat since the crisis. And the idea that we're almost increasing our organizing work together and recognizing, you know, this important moment, both as a moment to defend the school's role in our communities, but also to seize as an opportunity to kind of advance work that they've been working on for a long time. That has really been energizing and replenishing to feel the solidarity and commitment among the partners who haven't considered giving up on the future, right? That's, it's all aspirational work. It's all future-oriented work. So one recommendation to listeners is really to get out there, virtually get out there, and connect with and organize in solidarity with young people who are really concerned about what this will mean for their future, right? And doing that with folks, I think, will sort of give you life. I think the other thing that I'm hopeful for moving forward is that we won't forget the importance of these things whenever we reapproach some kind of new normal, and that these ways of connecting with folks that are almost being rediscovered are maintained, because I think it will actually, in some ways, we can strengthen some of the fabric of our families and communities and friendships by remembering how important it was to stay connected during a time when we physically could not do that.
Thanks, Jillian, Anne, Saun, Kyle, and Keith for sharing your experiences and your recommendations. And thank you to all the teachers, administrators, schoolhouse staff, and district personnel that are ensuring that public education is accessible for all children in these unprecedented times. And thank you to all of the healthcare professionals caring for the sick, the grocery store workers restocking shelves, the public transit workers ensuring transportation, the undocumented workers laboring in the fields, and the manufacturing workers producing the essential protective equipment that is so desperately needed in hospitals. We're all safer because of your sacrifice. Next month, we'll be speaking with Dr. Frank Adamson, an expert on the effort to privatize public education in both the United States and abroad. We'll be speaking to him about international examples of privatized systems of public schooling, the contextual factors that precede or facilitate privatization, and the enduring threat of privatization that exists in the United States. We hope that you enjoyed this month's podcast and that you and your families are safe. As always, thanks for listening, and remember that for the latest analysis of education policy, you can subscribe to the NEPC newsletter at nepc.colorado.edu and follow NEPC on Twitter at NEPC Tweet.